You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Darren Strauss joins me this week. He is the award-winning author of several books, including his memoir, Half a Life, and the novels Chang and Eng, The Real McCoy, More Than It Hurts You, and his new book, The Queen of Tuesday, a Lucille Ball story. Darren Strauss, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much.
While you were writing your new novel, in which Lucille Ball is a character, you did a lot of research into the life of Lucille Ball, and I read your piece in the Arts and Leisure section of the New York Times a couple of Sundays ago. And so how did you get interested in Lucy?
Well, thanks. I just thought she was such a cool person. And I'd read a bunch of biographies of her, and I thought the biographies were all rather dry. And I realized she was a very withholding person. She didn't share much about what it was like to be her. So, you know, if you're a biographer, you can give facts like the show began in 1951 and it was watched by the equivalent of 85 million people. And those things are true, but it doesn't really give you a sense of the texture of her life and what it would mean to be in the center of that sort of incredible fame. And so I realized, you know, if I write a novel about her, it could sort of be the best of both worlds, because when you're writing fiction, you ask yourself, you know, does this story make sense? Is this character compelling? And if you're writing nonfiction, you know, you say to yourself, this is not interesting here, but I can't change the facts. So I thought if I combine both and sort of have a hybrid kind of a book, it could be the most fun way to tell that story, and maybe in some strange way, the most truthful way to do it.
But she's not exactly the main character in your book. I mean, she's one of the characters. How did you decide on your approach to the story?
Yeah, I should say what the book is. Thanks. So the book is, as I said, it's a hybrid. It's sort of a biography of her golden period, and it's sort of a family memoir of my grandfather, and he's named, and it's all true. And then there's their passionate sexual affair, which I invented, and that's the novel part.
And did they ever meet, to your knowledge?
I was told they met at a party thrown by Donald Trump's father, which is the way the book begins. So it's rather funny. I started writing this book a long time ago, before Trump was president. So I guess I started writing it in, 2015. So it took me about 4 years to write. And so before I even knew Trump was going to be a candidate for president, let alone the president, I just heard about this party he threw, where his father threw this party, where Trump's father bought a giant swath of land on New York's Coney Island and destroyed this beautiful historic landmark, the first amusement park in the world by some measures. And there was this giant steel and glass cathedral, and Trump's father destroyed it to make crappy housing, as he was wont to do. And in order to avoid the bad publicity, he threw a party and had a bunch of celebrities there. And at the stroke of midnight, they threw bricks through the glass. And that was the place where my grandfather met Lucille. So I thought, well, that's a pretty cinematic opening. Just thinking it would be sort of a cool scene. And then once Trump became president, it had much more metaphorical power, I think. You know, here's Trump's family destroying something great and beautiful about America and manipulating the press to avoid scandal. So I thought, well, that's a pretty cool opening.
And having the fun of throwing bricks through this beautiful thing.
Yes, and making destruction a sort of party.
Lovely.
And so here we are. Yeah.
And so now, was Lucille Ball truly at this event, to your knowledge?
Yeah, I mean, that was the family lore. So I had heard that my grandfather knew Trump's father. Mm-hmm. And I heard that she was there. I haven't been able, to be honest, to verify that. But I had always heard that was the case. So I'm trusting my family not to have lied at that point. But yeah, my grandfather left my grandmother soon after that. And I was always sort of amazed at how he just abandoned her. And the interesting thing about that was he left her for her best friend. And for 30 years, she lived as a sort of hermit and still talked about him as her husband. I think one of the saddest things I've ever seen in my life in person was at her deathbed when my grandmother was talking to the nurse about her husband as if they were still married. And so I was always fascinated. What about him was so charming that he could sort of do these bad things and get away with it? And so that's sort of something else I wanted to examine.
Right. And so you took this opportunity to, so it's two books then really, but they meet.
Yeah. I wanted to write a love story. I feel like there hasn't been a great contemporary fictional love story. I was really influenced by Love in the Time of Cholera by Marquez and how complicatedly he looks at love. You know, so many movies, I feel like, and even novels end when love gets interesting, you know, like meeting is the sort of easy part. You know, in that book, the Marquez book, you know, it's a question, even was it love or obsession? And I wanted to examine that. You know, I think fame is such a warping thing. And so my grandfather met Lucille Ball and then went back to his fairly happy marriage and couldn't really abide being a normal person. He had, my grandfather in real life had wanted to become a writer and his father didn't let him do it. And so this brush with fame, I think, sort of ruined him in a way. And I think that's sort of why I became a writer myself, is because I was able to do it and he wasn't.
I've read a lot of the books that you have read about Lucy. In fact, some of the authors have been here talking to me about it. Stephen Canfer was here and the late Stephen Sanders was here too. And I love Lucy, as a matter of fact. And your book is a very serious book. And Lucy, of course, is known as being, you know, the funniest woman that ever lived. So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, she was not a funny person, left her own devices, by her own admission. Her fame is really interesting because she was the most famous woman in America, and actually maybe at that point in the history of America. I mean, one thing about her show was it was so popular that, and this is totally true, the water tables in all the big cities would drop when her show would break for commercial, because the entire country went to the bathroom at the same time. And that sort of, that sort of level of fame is just hard to fathom, right? I mean, 75% of homes with televisions watched it, not 75% of viewers, 75% of homes with TVs watched it. So, you know, incredible fame. And when asked about it, she said, "I'm not really funny. I can't tell jokes. I can't write scripts. I'm not a good dancer. I'm not a good singer. I'm not the best dramatic actress. And I'm not the prettiest person in the world." And, you know, this was at a much more misogynistic era when looks really matter. I mean, it's hard for women actors. It's hard for actresses now, of course. And, you know, the lookism of Hollywood. But in 1940s, 1950s, it was even worse. And so what was it about her? I think it was this desire to succeed, this unwillingness to give up. I mean, she tried to become famous at 16 and didn't really succeed until she was 40. And the funny thing is, she sort of made her television career about that. Every episode is about an untalented woman trying to become famous,
wanting to be on in the show.
In the show.
Yeah, let me just do the Vita Vita Benjamin commercial.
Exactly.
Well, it is interesting that she, I mean, you know, she made many, many, many films before she made I Love Lucy, and she was, you know, a reasonably successful actress and an actress on the radio as well.
Yes, she was fired. So yes, totally true. However, she was known as she wanted to be a big star, and she made it as sort of the queen of the bees for a short time and did a bunch of movies, as you said, some really good ones. You know, Douglas Sirk movie called Lord, which I think is great. But then was fired by RKO, fired by MGM, and her radio career had sort of foundered too. So TV was the last shot for her.
Yeah, and it's unusual for somebody, especially given, you know, the mythology about actresses in Hollywood that, you know, someone at the age of 40 would suddenly become the most famous woman in the world. And she, you know, I mean, I think she was incredibly beautiful, but yes, she doesn't look 40 when she was 40, but
Incredibly beautiful, I think. Yeah. No question about it. And incredibly talented. I mean, you watch those shows, the one you mentioned, the Lucy does a commercial is amazing. Of course, then she stomps the grapes and does the chocolates, but there are all manner of incredible episodes. You know, I just saw one recently again where she was trying to be a ballet dancer and she couldn't get her leg off of the bar. she's an incredible physical comedian.
And of course she was part of a interracial marriage at a time when that wasn't, in some states it was probably illegal.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, because, you know, that isn't necessarily even the case anymore. I mean, he was a Cuban guy, but, from a Spanish background. So I think today he might even be considered Caucasian, you know, as these things change because race is such a construct. But yes, at the time she made the show, CBS told her, we will allow you to do the show. And it was really them sort of taking a chance on her because, again, her career was coming to an end, it seemed like. And they said, okay, we'll let you do the show. But you have to have this blonde husband, Richard, I'm blanking on his name right now. Richard Denning. And she said, no, I want my husband. And they said, no, he's Cuban and you're white and we can't allow that. And she really took a stand. And, you know, not necessarily for the most moralistic reasons. I mean, it was great that she did take a stand and it was great that she was unprejudiced enough to have this great love affair with Desi at a time when, yeah, she probably was shunned for doing so. But she wanted to make him her husband because she knew that if he was left to his own devices, he would cheat on her. So she thought, if I am able to watch him all the time, he won't cheat. And he cheated. That's really why she made him her second banana on that show.
Keep an eye on him.
Yeah. And the funny thing, I mean, not funny, it's tragic for her. The interesting thing is, at a time of great prudishness on TV, remember, this is the early 50s, so on their show, they could not be shown sleeping in the same bed, even though they were married. So they had separate beds on air. So as that's happening, an article came out in LA Confidential showing that Desi was caught with two prostitutes. I actually just wrote about that too for Vanity Fair. I sort of become a lay expert and have written a bunch of articles on her. But yeah, so imagine that. So TV, 9 p.m. Monday night, can't sleep in the same bed as your husband. And then next morning, a newspaper shows he's with two prostitutes.
Confidential magazine.
Confidential magazine, yeah, which, you know, became the basis of the movie LA Confidential. Yeah.
Right. And Confidential magazine, one of the hallmarks of Confidential magazine is that everything they printed was true.
Well, I don't know about that. I think that they definitely were sued a lot, but this one was true because they had a number of eyewitness reports and Desi never really fought it. You know, there was no, I think he gave some sort of placid denial and then moved on.
I think the popular opinion was that if you fought it, you would just be drawing more attention to it. So that was one of the ways that Confidential was able to publish such shocking material, because they figured people wouldn't object to it because then they just call more attention to it and sell more copies for them.
True. Although I think there definitely were some high profile people who did find it. But yeah, that, I'm sure that's the case. But yes. I mean, his philandering was well known. And if you look at her autobiography, she refers to that. I mean, obliquely, but she refers to that article and doesn't say, how dare they publish this untruth. She says, you know, my husband was a philanderer and here's why.
Yeah. Yeah. Now in your the title of your book, The Queen of Tuesday, is kind of a clue, because we all know that Lucy was on Monday.
Yeah. So I did that for two reasons. One, I really wanted, you know, we live in the age of fake news, so I wanted to make it clear this was fiction. Even though there is a lot of research, as you said, and a lot of nonfiction, and I do think if you want to learn about Lucille, this is a way to do it. But yes, I wanted to make sure that people knew this was a fictionalized account, so I moved the night of the show. And also, I just thought, you know, I was originally going to call it The Queen of Monday, and I thought, that is not a good title. No one likes Mondays. The Queen of Tuesday. That's sort of serious. The Queen of Monday. I'm not going to read that, you know?
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. We're talking this week with Darren Strauss. He's the winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award. His new novel is called The Queen of Tuesday, a Lucille Ball story.
Talk a little bit about her Broadway stint that you wrote about in the New York Times in her play Wildcat.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about her, well, you mentioned her TV show. It's funny, she's known for this one show, but she did three other TV shows. One very short-lived one. The only TV failure she ever had was in 1986, I think. She did an NBC show after being on CBS forever. But again, she was a very determined woman. And so when she first tried to become famous, she was 16, ran away from home in upstate New York, came to New York City, and was sent home. The producer she talked to said, "You're not talented. You're not attractive enough. Go home. You're never going to make it." And she ran away 10 times to New York and tried to make it each time and failed each time. And then finally went out to California and made it. But so that stuck in her craw. And so even after being the pinnacle of televisual success in this country, you know, as famous as anyone could be, she said, "I'm going to make it on Broadway." And so she went back to New York City in 1960 and tried to make it and failed. You know, failed is maybe too hard a word. She had a commercial success, but she couldn't win over the critics. She couldn't remember her lines. It was really interesting. So she kept flubbing her lines, and she's such a charming presence. She would just turn to the crowd and say, "Well, what are you going to do? I'm a TV actress." And the crowd would love her. And the playwright wanted to kill himself, you know, and she broke her ankle. She passed out three times. She was playing a young woman, and when she was older, and she just couldn't do it physically. So it was sort of a debacle.
And it was a musical, and she sang and danced, even though singing and dancing were not her forte.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of funny details about that. Her vocal coach went to the director and said, "Why don't you just let her sing one note and have the orchestra play the melody?" Which, you know, is not a real recipe for good singing. So she said, "I can't sing even in the tub. I can't dance." And yet here she was doing all this stuff. And I think that's one of the reasons she hurt herself, because she was trying so hard. She was such a hard worker. And she, you know, like I said, she broke her ankle. She lost her voice. She couldn't remember the lines. It was sort of tragic in a way.
There were some musicals that played on Broadway and toured the country that starred actresses who were not known for musicals. For instance, there was Coco with Katharine Hepburn and Applause with Lauren Bacall. And I saw Mame on Broadway with Angela Lansbury. Gosh, it was one of the great things. Angela Lansbury and Bea Arthur were in it. and they were so great. It was one of the greatest things I ever saw. And then when they made the movie of Mame, and this was now, I think, probably 6 or 8 years later, mm-hmm. They made it with Lucy. And I don't know the story of how it came about, but I know that when I saw the movie, you know, every time you see Lucy, they've put some kind of gauze over the screen. I thought I had a brain tumor, because you can hardly see Lucy. They've got her as fuzzy as possible.
I think it was hard for her. You know, she was the icon of the 50s. And so I think, you know, when she aged, it was hard for her on TV, I think. And so, yeah, they, and Saturday Night Live used to make fun of that technique. They did a skit about Liz Taylor's perfume. And so when Liz Taylor would do the ad, the gauze was so thick, it looked like she was in a cloud. I think, you know, it's a way to sort of smooth out wrinkles or whatever, but yeah, it didn't really work for Lucille. That Mame, I think it was people just loved her. So I think it was a commercial hit, but it wasn't. And then she later played a homeless woman in a TV movie.
Oh yeah. Stone Soup or something like that.
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Which was a bag lady. Yeah. Yeah. Which was an admirable attempt at drama on her part. You know, a lot of comedians have tried that, right? I mean, Ed Wynn and Red Skelton and people like that had Danny Kaye certainly did dramatic parts that try to broaden their appeal.
Yeah. You know, for every Woody Allen, there's probably 20 people who can't do it. Like, you know, Woody Allen was able to make, I mean, he's got his own issues, obviously,
yeah,
but he was able to make the jump from.
He can do both.
Serious director.
I mean, I do think that Lucy is a good actor. You mentioned, I don't know if we were on the air, but you talked about Lured.
Yeah.
One of my favorite, it's a kind of a film noir with Boris Karloff, and it's got a great cast of people.
Yeah, and, yeah. I mean, it was an interesting one because it's sort of comical as noirs go, but it's more serious than certainly the sitcom. And yeah, it's Douglas Sirk. I mean, it's a really good movie.
Well, this book, it's called The Queen of Tuesday, a Lucille Ball story, and the author, Jan Strauss. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It was great talking with you.
Thank you, Darren Strauss, award-winning author of The Queen of Tuesday, a Lucille Ball story. We turn now to my next guest, Gerard Coppell.
He is an historian and the author of several books, including City on a Grid, How New York Became New York, and Bond of Union, Building the Erie Canal and the American Empire. His new book is called Not a Gentleman's Work, The Untold Story of a Gruesome Murder at Sea and the Long Road to Truth. Gerard Coppell, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Gary, great. Great to be here.
You know, in some ways it would be nice if this were like a book club and everyone had already read your book. Even though this book is nonfiction, it's kind of a mystery, so I don't want to give too much away. So what do you want my listeners to know about Not a Gentleman's Work?
Well, I guess we can tell them the basic setup, right? But we won't tell them who done it. They can figure that out. So this is a sailing ship, a barkentine, a three-masted sailing ship, headed from Boston to Argentina. Buenos Aires was the first stop, would have been the first stop, 1896. And they're carrying a load of New England pine lumber and stored below decks and on deck. It's a 175-foot ship, and there are 12 people on board. The captain, who is also the owner and the builder of the ship, his name is Charles Nash from Maine. His wife is on the ship, and not completely unusual because captains' wives often traveled with their husbands, especially those couples that didn't have any children. It's unclear why they didn't have children. He was 42. He was 39. It's one of those mysteries. And captain, wife, first mate, Thomas Bram. We'll talk more about him. The second mate, August Blomberg. We'll talk more about him. Six crew members, all from Europe. Three of them Swiss, and one French, one German, one Dutch. Not all that unusual either in the 1890s when American sailors had switched to steamships or had just given up the sea entirely. Those six crew members slept in the forward cabin. There were two cabins. And with them in the forward cabin sleeping there was the cook slash steward, Jonathan Spencer. And he was the only one of the 12 people on board who moved easily between the two cabins because he served the meals in the aft cabin and straightened up the rooms of Charles Nash, Laura Nash, the first and second mate, Thomas Bram, August Blomberg, and the 12th person on board, Lester Hawthorne Monks, a 20-year-old, proper Bostonian, not quite Brahmin level, but proper Bostonian. And he was on the boat because his parents had put him there because he had just flunked and drunk himself out of Harvard. And so those are our 12 people. As I said, the seven people in the forward cabin, five people in the aft cabin, the two Nashes, Bram, Blomberg, and Monks. And 7 days or 7 nights into what was supposed to be a 2 to 3 month voyage, depending on the winds. At 2 o'clock in the morning, the captain, his wife, and the second mate, who was off watch, the first mate was on watch on deck. The two Nashes and Blomberg were slaughtered in their separate sleeping rooms off the aft cabin with the ship's axe. And they took about 7 or 8 blows apiece, all to the head, pretty much. Their heads were mostly turned to pulp. And there were 4 people sleeping below at the time, the 3 who were killed. Thomas Bram was on deck, and Lester Monks. And he apparently slept through the whole thing. And it was he that discovered the what had happened. Now, whether he discovered what had happened after it happened or was somehow involved during it happening is a question.
So, well, your title promised that it would be a gruesome murder, and it certainly was. You lived up to it.
Yeah, it was, you know, axe murders tend to be.
So, was there any motive? Did anybody have any idea?
Nope. And I mean, we can cut forward a little bit. There were only remotely possible people who had done it. One was one of the crewmen who normally slept forward. He was on watch at the time, and he was steering the boat. The steering area was aft of the aft cabin. The argument is that he lashed the wheel, and the wheel was set to be lashed usually when the boat was at anchor or otherwise not in motion. You wouldn't lash the wheel when it was moving generally. Arguably, he would have lashed the wheel, gone below into the aft cabin where he'd never been as a regular member of the crew, gone into a room where the axe was stored, a room he'd never been in. He didn't know there was an axe there. Killed 3 of the 4 people, ignored the 4th one, Monks, went back up on deck and resumed steering the boat. Highly unlikely. The other person who might have done it, or one of the other persons who might have done it, was the first mate, Thomas Bram. He was on watch at the time. He might have snuck below and not been missed by his fellow watchmates on deck, the Charlie Brown, who was the guy steering, that was his nickname, and his 2 other crew members who were, 2 other watch members who were forward at the time. So Bram might have snuck below, killed 3 of 4 people, again, ignored the 4th for some reason, gone back up on deck and resumed his watch. Again, no motive for either of these 2 so far. And then the 3rd possibility is the guy who was not attacked, the 1 of the 4 people who was not attacked down there in the aft cabin, Lester Monks. He might have gone to the storage room where the axe was, and he knew where the axe was because his belongings, his personal belongings, were stored there as well, and he frequently went into that room. He might have gotten the axe, killed the 3 people, gone back into his room, and then, feigning surprise, discovered the captain murdered, and then his wife and the second mate gone up on deck and alerted the first mate. He also wouldn't have really had any motive unless, arguably, he had a thing for the captain's wife, who was not unattractive, and perhaps he fancied that she might be interested in him, or perhaps she fancied herself interested in him. We don't know. But
so it's a kind of an odd courtship behavior to smash her head with an axe. That doesn't usually go over well with.
Well, possibly he was attracted to her and she said, no, I am not interested in you. And then he got angry about it. I mean, it's also, you know, as unlikely as any of the other 2.
Well,
but somebody did it.
Is it completely unlikely that it's a suicide pact?
that was one of the things that was, no, it was never discussed, the suicide pact. It was a strange sexual trio. And they finally decided they couldn't hide it any longer, or that they wanted to hide it forever.
I see.
Then the one possibility that was suggested was, in fact, suggested by Thomas Bram, the first mate, and his lawyers, ultimately, that the second mate fancied the wife. He went after her. The captain woke up, heard what was going on, got the axe, went after the second mate. The second mate got the axe from him, killed the captain, killed the wife, then dealt himself fatal blows, left the axe up on deck where it was ultimately found, and then went down back below into his little cabin and died.
After having smashed his own head open with an axe.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, also
seems,
unlikely.
It seems unlikely. well, it's nice that we can laugh about it 100 years later. It's odd to think. Well, okay, I want to come back to the case and ask you a bunch of questions about it. But first, it's 1896, and they're sailing. Were there still a lot of sailing vessels in the 1890s?
You wouldn't think so. I mean, steamships had come in the 1830s, and by the late 1800s, there were a lot of steamships, but there were also still a lot of sailing vessels, because it was probably the overall numbers are about 50-50 on the world's oceans. And through the 1890s, as many sailing ships were built as steamships, because sailing ships are much cheaper to build, and also cheaper to operate. Because their motive force is wind, not coal or wood. So they're much cheaper to operate, and you can make more money. Many operators could make more money operating sailing ships and steamships.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking today with Gerard Coppell. He's the author of Not a Gentleman's Work, The Untold Story of a Gruesome Murder at Sea and the Long Road to Truth. Gerard Coppell, how did Lester Monks come to be on this ship?
Lester Monks' parents wanted him gone, and they booked him on this ship. There's no indication that they sought other ships. It may be that because it was a sailing ship, the voyage was long. I mean, they're going all the way down to Buenos Aires. It was estimated to take, and the ship had done that voyage numerous times. It was estimated to take, you know, 2 to 3 months, probably, maybe roughly 10 weeks, which is a good long time, as opposed to a steamship, which might have taken much less time. The parents just didn't want him around. In fact, if you start looking at, you know, circumstantial stuff, of the only three possible people who could have done it, and I don't know if I was clear about that earlier, but all the other crew members were forward on the ship. They'd never been in the aft cabin. There's no way they could have gotten to the aft cabin without other people having seen them. So the only three people who could have done this were the three people closest to the aft cabin at the time of the killing.
One of them was actually in the cabin asleep.
Yeah, one was asleep. One was on deck in forward of the cabin, and the other was on deck at the wheel after the cabin, behind the cabin.
If somebody were to strike a person with an axe in your bedroom, you'd probably wake up. You'd hear it.
Well, that's interesting. The two of the three dead people did not wake up, apparently. And there was like a rough autopsy done by the time they got back to Halifax, is where the boat initially got back to, a week after the killings. And the bodies were hopelessly... they were in bad shape by the time they got back there, but they were analyzed and for example, it was determined that they were each struck about 7 or 8 times. So that could be
although the crime scene itself had been disturbed, because they took the bodies and put them in a little boat, right?
That's right. Right. They couldn't leave the bodies down in the cabin because they were, stinking up the boat. So they sort of informally buried them in one of the ship's small boats, and then towed that boat behind the ship for the week that it took them to get to Halifax, which is the closest port to get to.
And once the captain of the ship was killed, then yeah. obviously he couldn't be the captain anymore. So who took charge and made decisions?
Well, the standard thing is the first mate takes over, and he did, Thomas Bram. He turned out to be less than authority-seeking or authority-commanding. And in fact, most of the decisions were made by the steward, who turned out to be a relatively honorable person in all of this, and Lester Monks, the passenger. Those two sort of made most of the important decisions, and Bram pretty much went along with everything. But Bram was essential because he was the only navigator on the boat. He was the only one who knew how to do celestial navigation, which of course was the only way to navigate in those days. And he very effectively got the boat back to Halifax the ship couldn't have gotten back to land any quicker had anybody else tried to do it.
Well, how did you, Gerard Coppell, how did you come upon this crazy story?
I'd written three books about New York City and aspects of New York City's history New York City and New York State. And I decided I wanted to leave town for a little bit. So I was looking into writing a book about Joshua Slocum, who was the first guy to sail alone around the world, 1895 to 1898. And he wrote a book about it called Sailing Alone Around the World. And it was a big bestseller. He was a celebrity for a bit. The book is still in print. It's now out of copyright, and there are probably, you know, eight editions of it in print right now. But I was always interested in him, and there's a good edition of his book by Penguin, which is fairly substantially footnoted. And near the end of his book, and the boat that he was sailing alone around the world was a 37-foot oyster sloop. And the question arose, and he realized that the question would be, well, how could he sail alone for thousands and thousands of miles? He had to sleep and eat at times. So he explains in the appendix to his book how he rigged up his little boat to steer itself. And he says in a brief aside that this question of boats being rigged to sail on their own was the issue at the recent trial in Boston. And I wouldn't have known what that was, except there was a little footnote in the Penguin edition that described the trial of Thomas Bram, the first mate of the Herbert Fuller, the ship we're talking about, because the question had been whether the crewman, Charlie Brown, had lashed the wheel and the ship had sailed itself for a bit while he supposedly did his dirty work, which in fact he didn't. But that little indicator suggested to me that I move from Joshua Slocum, leave him alone for a bit, and go have a look at this bloody voyage. And that's how the book came about.
So to what degree then, as we move into this idea of if there's a trial and the guy who's on trial, yeah, is seemingly the least likely person to have committed the crime. Yeah. Race, class, what part did those play in this case?
Race and class, that's interesting. So Thomas Bram was from St. Kitts. It's an island, St. Christopher's, an island in the Caribbean. He was largely black. His mother was black. We know that. We're not certain about his father because his father disappeared when Tom, as he called himself, was young. But Tom Bram was black. Now, he often passed himself off as white, and successfully. He was relatively light-skinned. He was fairly swarthy and had a weathered look. And he was very interested in passing himself off as white. He often claimed on unofficial papers that he was from Nova Scotia, but on official documents, on formal government documents, he acknowledged that he was from St. Kitts. And he got married when he was young. He left St. Kitts by boat, eventually wound up in New York, and a number of years before this voyage in 1896, he married a woman who was who had German-American parents. She was white, and she was did not think he was black. So he passed, and as the expression was then, and she was very surprised to learn many years later that he was in fact black. Didn't bother her though. During the time that it takes to get the boat from where the murder took place in the middle of the ocean back to Halifax, suspicion first centered around the helmsman, Charlie Brown. He was shackled to the base of one of the masts. And as they approached Halifax, suspicion moved to Thomas Bram himself, and he was shackled to another mast. And so when they got to Halifax, there were two prime suspects, and very quickly, suspicion focused only on Thomas Bram. The crew was sent back to Boston, and there's very quickly a trial in December. I mean, can you imagine justice working that quickly these days? Murders in July, trial in December. And Bram, after a 4-week trial, was convicted. And so it was a jury trial. The jurors were all, you know, white males from Boston to the Boston area. Was there racism? I've read the thousands of pages of trial testimony. It's the original and the only copy of the trial testimony is at the Harvard Law Library, and now is posted online. If anybody would like to read it, it's 5,500 pages. There were two trials. In none of those pages is one word of racial anything pertaining to Bram's race. In the hundreds of newspaper articles, and this was a major story, major, you know, headline story in Boston, in New England, around the country even. New York Times, you know, played it very big. The Washington, what was it called? It wasn't the Washington Post. What was it? The Washington Daily Times, I think, you know, played it very big. And it was covered in Europe as well. In none of the coverage that I read, and I'm talking about thousands of articles, is there any derogatory mention of Bram? And I certainly thought I was going to find that, and I didn't. So race did not have an obvious role in Bram being found guilty. But no matter how questionable a character Monks was, and perhaps unreliable as a witness, his testimony at the trial was considered very valuable, and it was very much against Bram. There was very little questioning of the quality of Monk's testimony or of him personally. There's a little bit that you can somehow, every once in a while, pick up between the lines, but it's not obvious. And certainly as a class issue, it was definitely Monk's testimony was valued, and Bram's position as a defendant worked against him, at least in the court. At least in court. Public opinion, though, was very different. And when Bram was initially convicted, public opinion, when the jury went out, and it took him a day and a half to come to a decision, the speculation had been that he would be acquitted. And he wasn't. And when he was found guilty, there was a lot of outrage. The case doesn't shout out as a race case or a class case. It really is just a mystery case. Mm-hmm. You know, because there's no way that Bram did it.
Right.
And it's hard to really, you know, say exactly how either of the other two might have done it.
Well, it's a fascinating book. It's called Not a Gentleman's Work, The Untold Story of a Gruesome Murder at Sea and the Long Road to Truth. And the author, my guest, Gerard Coppell, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.